Well, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that when we were vacationing a few weeks back in the beaches, on the beaches of the Outer Banks in North Carolina, we saw something that we had never seen before, something for the first time, a shark. And it was, in fact, a spinner shark that's known for its incredible acrobatic abilities. And this is what they do. When they come upon, say, a school of fish that they say want to snack on, because I think that's all the sharks want to do when they come upon a school of fish, what they do is they approach the school of fish from underneath, and they swim up very rapidly until they get into the school of fish, and then they start snapping back and forth, trying to catch these fish, get their snack. And then because they're ascending so fast and they're doing this back and forth motion, they start to spin in the water, and so it propels them out of the water, spinning, and they may spin several times before they return back into the water and swim away. It's a wonder to see. And we saw a shark doing this multiple times throughout the day on the beach, and actually Adam called it. We didn't even know it was a spinner shark, and Adam's like, "I'm telling you, that's a spinner shark." And we're like, "What? What shark?" But you can imagine everybody on the beach, they stand up, they stop what they're doing, and they watch with excitement, with wonder. Scientists, they still don't know why the spinner shark does this. There's a bunch of theories out there, of course. The one I like best, though, is that this is just a fun thing for a shark to do. I mean, what else are you going to do after you eat a bunch of yummy snacks? Do a few spins. That's what I would do. Either way, I think if a guru knew about the spinner shark, it would have made the list of the things too wonderful for him to understand. We're in a series, sermon series, on the book of Proverbs. And this is actually the second last sermon of the series. And today we're again looking at the second last chapter of Proverbs. Proverbs 30, and it contains the words of Agur, this mysterious guy whose words somehow became also the word of God. And his words are actually one long poem. Last Sunday, we heard the first part of the poem with as Eric gave his stellar sermon. That's the prayer of Agur. That's the first part of the sermon. The second part, the latter part, is what you could see as the answer to that prayer or that poem. Did I say sermon? I meant poem. So one is the prayer, and one you can see and will see is something like the answer to what he prays for. So for example, in the prayer, not unlike Socrates, who famously said, "I know that I know nothing." Agur starts with acknowledging his ignorance, but a little more intensely than Socrates. He says, "I'm a stupid man. I have not learned wisdom." But he doesn't stop there. He makes a request. He makes the first of two requests: "Deliver me from falsehood and lying." Or conversely, you could say, "Let me see and live and speak only the truth." And in the context of Proverbs and this poem, if you're paying attention, it would also include, "Let me only speak in accordance with the truth and the wisdom of your word and in your world." So he just said earlier, every word of God proves true. Do not add to his words, lest he rebuke you and you be found a liar. And Proverbs makes it really clear that God has interwoven this truth and wisdom within his creation. It takes discernment to see this, a particular way of perceiving. But with those with eyes to see, you can behold this truth in the world. So Agur is asking for God's wisdom here, and it's apparent that God answers this prayer. Because right after the prayer, suddenly Agur has a lot of wisdom to share. 20 verses of wisdom he shares after this prayer. And it's apparent, as we're going to see, God answers not just this first request, but the second one, which is very much like it. Feed me, Lord. Fill me with only what I need. Lest I forget you in pride, or lest I get too little and I feel like I need to steal in greed. I don't have enough. Which requires us not only just being filled with the right amount of stuff, but also with the right way of seeing our stuff and other people's stuff and all stuff. Because you could have the right amount of things in your life, all that you really need, but you just don't happen to see it that way. I think that's more our problem. For example, in pride, you might say, I deserve more than this. I deserve what they have. Or in greed, you might say, I need more. I need what they have. And these two, pride and greed, two of what have been called the seven deadliest sins of the seven deadliest sins, these feature prominently in this passage. Things that we need to be healed from. We need to be able to see how ugly they are and that we need to be, in fact, delivered from them. So the second request, it's not just for the right amount of things, it's for the right way of seeing our things and all things. That keeps us out of these ugly ditches of pride on the one side and greed on the other and keeps us on that path of humble dependence and contentment. And so these are really two sides of the same prayer. One is, deliver me from this distorted way of seeing life. And the other is more, help me see properly. Heal me of this distorted vision. Give me the proper way to see my things and all of life. And God, I think, answers this prayer for Agur. It sounds like a girl, I keep saying. His name is hard to pronounce. But we see how he opens the eyes of Agur, how he heals his vision. So eyes and vision, the way one sees and one doesn't see, how we see, it's really a big deal in this passage, if you're paying attention. So, for example, may you notice Agur, he starts off there. There are those who are pure in their own eyes, yet they're not cleansed of their own filth. Excrement is actually the more literal translation of that word, filth. So these people think, these people stuck in pride, see themselves as the most wise and righteous, undefiled, clean people around. Meanwhile, they're covered in their own excrement. Pretty gruesome, gross language. They're worse than the people they despise, but they're blinded by their own arrogance, their own hubris. How lofty are their eyes, how high they lift their eyelids, says Agur. These are the people who roll their eyes, is the imagery here, as they mock. They, quote, mock and scorn their mothers and fathers. And this doesn't just have to be our biological mothers and fathers. This can be any of those mothers and fathers who've gone before us, who represent that collective wisdom in whatever we're talking about, whatever discipline or vocation or community of faith you belong to. These people who represent and communicate this collected wisdom to you, and these people roll their eyes at such people. Because they know better. They deserve better. Well, we know that it doesn't go well for such people. And Agur has stark language for this. He says, their eyes are going to be plucked out by ravens of the valley and eaten by vultures. In other words, their pride is going to leave them brutally blind. They might think they're seeing more clearly than everybody else, but their eyeballs have been or will be eaten by buzzards. and they're standing in the gutter in their own excrement. The point of this is a problem. Pride is a problem that we need to be delivered from, that distorts our vision, gives us a false way of seeing things. And so we need to pray like Agur, deliver me from this falsehood. That's pride is falsehood. Greed is falsehood in the biblical understanding. The problem, of course, is pride keeps us from seeing this. Isn't Agur a little extreme here? Is pride really that bad? Is greed really this ugly in these images that he's given? If we're asking that, we need to pray this prayer. We have yet to see how ugly and present this pride and greed can be in our own lives. Which is why many times we don't pray this prayer first, the Agur prayer. We need somebody else in our life to pray it for us. Somebody, a friend, a mother or father figure, who sees the greed and the pride in our lives and prays to God, God, open their eyes just enough for them to see something of this, that they would be repulsed by it, that they would want to pray this prayer too, deliver me from this and give me a new way of seeing, a new way of humble dependence and contentment. So I wonder if Agur had someone in his life who did this for him before he prayed this prayer. And because of that prayer, he was then opened. He was given eyes to see something of this reality in his own life. I wonder if Agur was not the Scrooge of his day, blinded by his own pride and greed. How he maybe was given visions of this too. How he slandered a servant to his master, as he puts it, because he wanted to make his servant, this guy, this worker of some supervisor, look bad, because he wanted himself to look good, because he wanted that position of that servant, that worker. He saw that pride, that ugliness, and then he saw the visions of the ravens coming to pluck out his proud eyes and him standing in the gutter of his own excrement. I wonder then, was he given these visions of greed and that maybe they were touching on his own greed, this powerful imagery of this blood-sucking leech representing greed, who has two daughters who call out, give, give, and four who respond, never enough. That's greed, never enough. There's the barren womb and the grave, spanning the beginning and end of life. There's the parched land and the devouring fire, representing the greedy elements from one to another. Never enough money or possessions on one hand. Never enough control or retribution on the other hand, depending on where you are on the political economic spectrum. Then Agur sees the world tremble because too many are being driven by all this. Too many want to replace or overthrow those who are in authority over them because they know better, because they could do better, they deserve better. Too many are like the fool who is never filled enough. And the earth trembles because when that keeps going unrestrained, that leads to the collapse of a civilization, which history proves again and again. So I think if God were to show somebody this, a natural response would be what we see at the beginning of Agur's prayer. I'm weary, O God. I am weary, O God, and I am wasting away at the sight of all this and my own implication in this. I don't know anything. Deliver me from all this falsehood and show me another way of seeing life, the way of humble dependence and contentment, which is what God gives to Agur, if we're paying attention, which is apparent in what Agur says in the very center of this passage when he says this. Three things are too wonderful for me. Four, actually, I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky. The way of a snake on a rock. The way of a ship on the high seas. And the way of a man with a woman. Do you see and feel that different tone, that different way of seeing things? It's the way of wonder. And wonder is one of the ways God heals our distorted, greedy, proudful vision of life. Unlike greed and pride, which curves our vision and limits our vision inward to just our own desires, notice here how wonder expands our vision outward. It spans the sky, the land, the sea, the human landscape. It includes the elements and animals, human culture, human intimacy. And it doesn't distort our vision like pride and greed does. It actually helps us to see things as they are and to see the beautiful, mysterious way of things. There's a fantastic story by George MacDonald called The Golden Key, and it's a tale of Moss and Tangle who are brought together because of this golden key found at the end of a rainbow. And the story takes them through these enchanting realms and all kinds of challenges to try and find this door that this key unlocks. And I'm not going to tell you what I think that door unlocks. I'll let you figure that out if you read the book or the story. And on the way, they actually participate in these baptismal-type rituals. So clever, that purify them and prepare them to enter the land from which the shadows fall. As it's put in the book, it's a beautiful book. And it's to prepare them and enable them to live as childlike children of God again. At the beginning of the tale, they don't really see each other, if you're paying attention. They can't really understand and see each other. But as they go on, wonder has this transformative effect on them. It binds them together and it enables them to see the world and each other more clearly, with more vitality and life. It's a beautiful book. It's the kind of story that can awaken that childlike, awestruck wonder, not just in the characters and its transforming power, but in the readers who read the book. It takes about 30 minutes to read. I would recommend that if you're looking for a post-sermon read. I would take 60 minutes, though, to let this book do that work in you. Wonder, it heals us of our pride by fostering actually humility in us, right? It impresses upon us the limits of our understanding and the vastness of existence. And it heals our greed by fostering contentment, by saturating us and satisfying us with the beauty and wisdom in life on planet Earth. When you're living in a state of wonder, you're not thinking about how can I exploit these things or these people. You're not thinking about how can I exalt myself over these people. In a state of wonder, you are just more than content with whatever you have at that very moment. It's what the psychology calls the self-transcendent emotions. That's what wonder is about. And the nature of wonder, again, in contrast to greed, it's something that you just don't want to keep to yourself. What do you want to do when you're in a state of wonder? You want to tell somebody about it. Look at that sunset I'm beholding. I would argue the best scientists, the best poets, the best theologians, the best whatever discipline among us are those who've been moved and are moved by wonder to discover and then share life's and mysteries and God's mysteries with people. Einstein's wonder about the universe, that's what drove him to explore the depths of the universe. And what led him to share about it in his theories and his writings, and has led, of course, to some of the most revolutionary ideas in the history of the world. When we see something mysterious and wonderful, we just want to talk to people about it. That's what Agur is doing in this poem. He tells us about the wonder of this thing, these things here he's seeing in these little wonder sections. He tells us about the wonder, the wisdom of these small, vulnerable creatures, the ants and the lizard. He's doing it more as a parabolic poet than a scientist, of course, in here. But he's seen, he's been captivated by something beautiful, something wise in God's creation. And he wants to tell us about it. He's in a state of wonder. And there's lots to tell. G.K. Chesterton in The Tremendous Trifles wrote this: "The world will never starve for want of wonders, but only for want of wonder." And I think that the mindfulness movement gets something of this and is trying to respond to this. I think all the attention given to flow that we're seeing in our day gets something of this. Abraham Heschel, in his work, God in Search of Man, he writes that actually wonder is a necessary precursor to faith. And that in fact, to be spiritually alive is to be in a state of wonder. Well, of course, the proper context and foundation for this is the fear of God. If you pay attention to Proverbs, you pay attention to Scripture, the proper context and foundation for this wonder is the fear of God, because the fear of God is all about wonder. It's being in awesome wonder of God and His Word and His world. And the fulfillment, of course, of this is with the one we call wisdom, who heals the eyes of the blind, the one in whom we are baptized, the one who gives us second birth, who enables us to be born again in that awe-struck, childlike wonder, the children of God. One last thing to notice in this passage. If you read this, you notice that Agur goes back and forth between these little wonder passages and then these stark images of greed or warnings about pride. So, for example, right after the four things that are too wonderful for him, he gives this picture of greed, of sexual greed, lust of this adulteress, saying, "The way of the adulteress who eats and wipes her mouth and says, 'I have done no wrong.'" And then right after the noble and majestic stride of the lion and the mighty king that he notices, he goes into this warning about pride. He says, "Don't exalt yourself, or you're going to get a bloody nose." It's the imagery. Why is he doing this? I think he's doing this because it is so easy to slip out of a state of wonder and go back into greed and pride, a state of greed and pride. It's so easy to be in a state of wonder and see the beauty of things and then just slip into lust. It's so easy to be looking at the majestic stride of the lion and the king, and then suddenly you realize and you find yourself wanting to be that king, wanting to tell everybody what to do and to have all their stuff. And what are we going to do when that happens? Well, we better pray this prayer. Deliver me from this falsehood, O God. Fill me with what I need. Fill me and heal me with holy wonder. May it be so.